operated one Delta, so plenty of people were on. I just used 80 meters, 40 meters. And one of the clubs I heard was on 80 meter phone, and that's King's Paw, you know, KT2RC. I was glad to get that. And, okay, Dick, yeah, let me, give you a report here. This is WS Flex. Here we got, a couple of things that happened over this weekend. And it kind of mixed in with field day, so I had to remember what time these rockets were going up. SpaceX was launching two rockets for the weekend. One on Friday afternoon, and then roughly a little over 48 hours, so 2 days later, one that went up today, and you know, not too many hours ago, probably it was around 4:30. So one from one side of the country, and one from the other, one from Cape Canaveral, and one from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Cape Canaveral was very successful. They launched from Launch Complex 39A. You know, they've taken over that complex. That's the same one that NASA always used for the shuttles and Saturn V. Well, now SpaceX has it. And they successfully launched a geosynchronous satellite for Bulgaria. Drop it. And that got up to geosynchronous orbit exactly the way they figured. And the first stage came back and landed on a barge ship out in the Atlantic Ocean, about 400 miles out. And that was the same first stage that had launched back in January from California and also landed on a barge. So this one first stage rocket has now successfully launched from California, landed on a barge. They brought it back eventually to Cape Canaveral, launched from there, and landed on to another barge. Bit of a hard landing, but it was successful. They'll be able to recover all those engines, the rocket itself, and maybe eventually relaunch it again. So that worked out good. And then, sure enough, 2 days later, this afternoon today, they launched another rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And the payload there was more of these Iridium satellites. The one that launched in January that I mentioned before that was relaunched today from Cape Canaveral was the same one that launched the Iridium satellites back in January. Well, sure enough, today they're launching the second group of Iridium satellites. And that wound up very successful. Got up through there, these kilometers, but it's roughly about 400 miles up, and they put it into a different plane. I believe there's 10 or 11 satellites, and then the same was true for when they first did it back in January, and they now have there's four more scheduled launches. Roughly 10 satellites each to be launched probably not by the end of the year, but maybe by the beginning of next year. They should complete that. But very successful. They landed that particular first stage also on a barge. So I'm sure they're very happy about that. They're bringing the cost of launching these things way down. You can take a country like Bulgaria with, you know, maybe 7 million people or 8 million people and put together a satellite, pay for a launch. That would not be able to happen too long ago. That's their first real communication satellite to be launched. They did launch a weather-type satellite maybe 15 years ago. But now these countries that you know, for being left out of the mix with communication satellites. Now could do that. You know, there's a lot of mountains and things near Bulgaria. You really need a direct shot looking down into their areas to make them good RF for TV and internet or whatever they're going to use it for. Communications. Let me drop it to WS2N. So, going to talk about that, and then one topic that we've covered many years ago, it was launched in 2007 and still on its mission, is the Dawn spacecraft. That's the one with the three ion engines on it, and it went originally to orbit the asteroid Vesta, and it stayed there for over a year. And eventually left that orbit with the ion engine. And for a little over 2 years now, it's been in orbit around Ceres. And successfully still in orbit, although it's had some problems pointing, you know, its cameras and the antennas, because they've had problems with their momentum gyros. The big gyro heavy spinning things are giving them problems. There were four on board. They've lost like three of them. Now to keep oriented, they're using one gyro, and they keep using up hydrazine fuel, you know, on their thrusters. And but they managed to, you know, keep it going, still doing science. But now at the end of this month, they've run out of extended missions. So the scientists are trying to decide what to do with this. Leave it in orbit around Ceres, and and they do have the capability of leaving the orbit. Still have enough xenon fuel for the ion engines, so they might leave that orbit and go into where, you know, into the solar system looking for more targets. Let me drop it. So, okay, so there's other things we can cover here, but I figure let me just cover those topics for now. You know, the European Space Agency is always doing things. They've got a big plan for a spacecraft called Space Rider, maybe 3-4 years down the road, to eventually put satellites in space and eventually have this thing come back, Space Rider, and land on a runway. So, you know, we've done it before, and now they're looking to do it. So there's a lot of things should be changing. Should be very interesting in the next couple of years. Back to you, Dick. Do you have any comments or anybody else? This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Let's first find out if there's anybody with any questions for Paul on space-related hardware. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2N.
Okay, somebody got cut off. I heard N2 blank. Want to give that to me again? Wait for the beeps and slowly give us the N2 something. Okay, I think you're over-modulating and jumping out of the machine. I only heard November. So speak more softly. And please repeat your call letters and name. K2RIW.
November 2, November Bravo Romeo. Now here is John.
Okay, you were 100% copy that time, John. November 2, November Bravo Romeo. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
I just have curiosity about the engines. I heard about them a long time ago. I was just wondering if any advances about and fuel consumption and, you know, whether or not the power to weight ratio is productive or stuff like that. Back to you.
Okay. When you talk loud, you jump out of the machine, so there was some dropout. I can tell you're asking a question about fuel consumption. So please repeat the question. What's the spacecraft you're asking about, and tell me what you're asking about fuel consumption. Back to you, John. N2N, NBR, K2RIW.
Sounds like he's looking for an ion space topic, ion rocket.
Okay, why don't you answer that question for him, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Sounds like he's asking about the advancements, maybe where we are today with ion rockets. They've been around, like this one here, Dawn, launched on a Delta rocket, Delta II rocket, back in 2007. I believe it was the second or third spacecraft to have an ion engine on it. There was something called a Smart One. A deal between NASA and the European Space Agency, and that was successful. And then they launched this thing. This one has three ion engines, and they're sticking out of the back, but I think, I don't know, 30 degrees or so apart from one another. So, you know, you can change the direction of where you're going. None of the three engines fire at the exact same time. It's only one engine at a time, and they'll be firing for months or even years at a time. They use neon gas, neon fuel. They could use other fuel, but neon is a heavy, very heavy gas, a lot of protons, neutrons, and stuff. So because it's dense, it has the ability to have better impulse compared to a lighter gas, which they can do the same process with. But a xenon looks like the most popular gas that they use. It's now being used on a lot of satellites that are going up. Probably, it's got to be a dozen at least. Or more, some launched by European Space Agency on the Ariane 5 rocket. SpaceX has launched a couple of satellites specifically. The military has launched it. They all have these ion engines, including now the X-37B. X-37B is a plane-like spacecraft that, you know, when it's launched on, you know, from Cape Canaveral on a Atlas V rocket, encapsulated in a bearing, so you don't see it when it takes off. Let me drop it. They've launched. They have. You know, we have two of these in the Air Force arsenal. Two X-37Bs, and they've been flying since 2010. First one went up right before the last shuttle retired in 2011. So the first one went up, stayed up for many months, and then the next one went up, stayed for over a year. And it's been going like that. The last one just came back 750 days or so. But the interesting one about the last one is they put a Hall ion thruster on board on that military vehicle when it stayed up there for over 2 years. And, you know, most of everything, the X-37B is top secret, but they did say that they were testing out Hall ion type of rocket system. You know, so they were changing, different heights of the orbit, the inclination to some degree, and they were just testing it out, and from what I understand, it was very successful. So you're going to see a lot more of these things, and far as impulse. And then actually it's very, very thin to be used as an exhaust. But because they can use it for months and years on end at a time, you can get tremendous velocity from this thing. The Dawn spacecraft that we were just talking about in the beginning, and that beginning part of the space portion of the net, the Dawn spacecraft went into orbit around the asteroid Vista, stayed there, and then it was the first spacecraft ever to orbit a celestial body and then deorbit it, and then eventually it went into orbit around Sirius and still has enough fuel on board to deorbit that. So that gives you an idea of what these things could do. You know, you could never do it with the chemical rocks that, you know, we've been using since the beginning of the space race. Back to you, K2RIWWS, and I hope I gave some kind of an idea of the ion story. Back to you.
K2LR.
LR recognized. And a quick question I've got for you before I turn it over to LR. I missed the prefix. I think I know who that is. The xenon gas is a stable element. Doesn't mix with anything else. It's neutral. So I presume you have to go through some kind of a process to ionize the xenon gas first to break it into positive and negative charged particles, so to speak, so that you can accelerate it. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I know it's an inert gas, and yeah, that's really good. It doesn't react with anything. And then, yeah, they do separate the protons from the electrons. Different systems on how they blow the exhaust out. Like the protons go out one side, and then the electrons actually have to go out and neutralize the exhaust. Otherwise, the whole spacecraft would become negatively charged or something of that nature. So they have this whole process, and that's pretty much, you know, all I know about it. The exact system of how they do it, I'm not really sure. I know that it takes a lot of electricity, and for instance, on Dawn, it's relatively a small spacecraft. The wings on it, the solar wings, it's 68 feet long, big solar wings. So, you know, it does eat up a lot of power to do that process. Back to you, Dick, and okay.
Okay, go right ahead with your question.
So this is AC2LR Mobile. Two-part question for Paul. Do you have a website that you access that has all of the international launches that you can see what Japan is doing, what Russia is doing, you know, different countries are launching at the same time? And also, do you know if there's some sort of air traffic control agreement for the case that, you know, things get too busy in space, how we all regulate that we don't crash into each other?
This
is AC2LR, back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Paul.
That was CW. That was most of the contacts I made today with CW. Okay, spaceflightinsider.com. NASA, spaceflightinsider.com. That's the name it goes under. Put that into Google, and I'm sure it'll pop up. And they have tremendous coverage of all the different rockets around the world that are going up, India and Russia. And when they you know, they'll talk about each one going up. There's another website that actually gives all the different launch times for all the different rockets. That's Space Flight. Wait a minute. This one's Space Flight. But I'll have to find the other website. They all sound similar. And I can give you that one too. That just gives you the schedule of all the different rockets. But if you want to find out about these rockets, pretty much when they're going to be going up, that's the best one. And this guy's named Ryan something. His last name. And he does live transmissions. He'll go to Florida or California, and he'll sit there and interview somebody. He's pretty good. But that's probably the best website for local and international. Back to you, Kay.
Thank you, Paul. Do you know if we have any international regulations that kind of control for, I don't know what you call it, you know, for us not crashing into each other or, you know, launching in some trajectories that somehow we may collide or do something like that? Back to you.
I know all the space ferry nations have agreements for launches, you know, to let other countries know when they're going to launch. Some of them don't want to go by that, you know. North Korea has problems with that. But most of them will let other countries know about it before launch. And then there's coordination for satellite locations, too. You know, that has to be agreed upon. So, especially in the near future. You know, you've got maybe 100 geosynchronous satellites flying around right now. And that all has to be coordinated with the other countries, you know, between all the ones that are space-faring nations, Russia, China, or even India now, those geosynchronous satellites, they all are on board with, you know, who's going to be located at what position. And now in the future, you know, your lower orbit, that's going to be a problem. The most critical that you've got Net 1 that wants to launch, 900 satellites or something. I think they just put a request in for 2,000 more, and SpaceX wants to do 4,000 satellites. And I'm sure that's going to probably run into some paperwork problems with all the other countries, because they're thinking about doing similar things too. And the reason for all these satellites that they want to put up, you know, they want to connect the world on the internet. So they're going to be internet type satellites, thousands of satellites. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
The most critical piece of real estate in space is the geosynchronous orbit. What's unique about geosynchronous orbit is that when you're at roughly 22,300 miles above the surface of the Earth, and if you're directly above the equator, then the signal sits in one spot. The satellite sits in one spot. You aim the ground station at that spot, and nothing moves for 24-hour days. The rate at which the satellite goes around the Earth and the rate at which the Earth turns are lockstep. But it's got to be exactly at the equator. If you start off below the equator on this half of the Earth's rotation, then you'll be above the equator on the other half. You really got an inclination of orbit. So geosynchronous orbit is one-dimensional real estate. It only has a longitude. Latitude is zero. As such, you need an agreement between you and Intelsat before you can launch a signal into that one-dimensional real estate. It's real prime territory. On top of that, once you've been given an assignment, your geosynchronous satellite has to stay within a 1 kilometer cube of that address. If you drift north or south, east or west, up or down, by the orbit can become elliptical because you're not at the right altitude. It can become a figure eight pattern in space because you start off at the wrong latitude. There's a whole lot of things that have to be just right. And if you're given a 1 kilometer, I think it is, cube of space, and you've got to stay within that 1 kilometer cube, or you pay a fine. Because you start becoming a hazard to everything else around you. So that's the most critical one. All the others, I am guessing, let me drop. I am guessing that the emphasis is on the launcher, because he's got a very expensive satellite. He doesn't want to crash it into something else because of the loss of his satellite, as well as what will happen with the other guy suing him. So by some means, you have to keep track of every other piece of space junk. I think there's thousands of pieces of junk that NORAD is keeping track of, but are discarded shields and nuts and bolts and explosive devices and whatever, and spent boosters. There's all kinds of stuff up there that NORAD has to keep track of. And there's a hell of a lot of other stuff that you got to worry about before you do a launch to make sure you don't run into any of it. Give me some further words on this, Paul. WS2N, KQI, W in the Tech Van.
Yeah, that's very good, Dick. No, what you said there is very true. There's a space agreement for a lot of things, locations, satellites. We were agreed with other countries years ago not to have any arms in space. You know, you can't have a big nuke floating around getting ready, ready to be launched at will. There's agreements on not claiming the moon or asteroids. And there's a lot of lawyers involved with that. They're all trying to change that or make exceptions to the rule. I know that, you know, it's becoming more and more commonplace. The private satellites that are going up have to coordinate with the government. Even the one that launched a month or so ago, the Electron rocket from New Zealand, and they have another flight going up in about another month. They have to coordinate. They have to be licensed with a certain country. It's actually licensed with the United States. So now your military mission, top secret one, went up a couple of days ago, about two days ago, from Russia. It was launched on a Soyuz rocket from Plesk, Russia, in the northern launch facility for a polar launch. Most of these polar launches, by the way, a lot of them are satellites that are surveillance type satellites. Besides communication satellites, a lot of them, you know, they're spying on one another. So they launched one a couple of days ago. They didn't tell anybody it was going off until the last day or two, and then they tell everybody. Because what happens is, you know, if the United States sees a launch from northern Russia going over the pole, we'd want to be real curious to make sure that's you know, going up for military purposes, not, you know, not going to rain down nukes on us. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
Okay. Good question, Jay. Okay. AC2LR, Mobile, K2RIW. Hopefully that answered most of your question, Kate. I am also curious where you spent field day over this last weekend because of where you live. I'm guessing that you could have gone to the Limar group, the Gizmar group, the Lockfield group. So which field day site did you spend time with this weekend? AC2LR, Mobile, K2RIW. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, Dick. I spent field day working indoors. So I did not get to participate in field day this year. If I may, I have two addendum questions to what you and Paul just shared. Dick, when you said a satellite has to stay within 1 kilometer of the spot that it was designated to synchronize with, who's the regulatory agency? That's what I'm looking for, the regulatory agency that they would pay that fine to. And if somebody only tells about their launch 2 days before it's going to happen, what would happen if two countries, say everybody wants the spot above, like nearest to North Korea, Russia, China, the United States, and we all decide to launch next Thursday, and then we tell each other Tuesday night, and then we have to fight about it, you know, like, so who, how do we, who's the judge and jury on that? Back to you.
Yeah, I'll be turning this back to Paul in a minute, but in the case of geosynchronous satellites, the regulatory agency there is Intelsat. Intelsat is a consortium of the United States and a bunch of European countries that have gotten together and decided to control the one-dimensional real estate that is geosynchronous orbit. Arguably, that is the most valuable piece of real estate out there in space. And they want you to stay within approximately a 1 kilometer cube. Otherwise, you will be paying a fine to Intelsat if you exceed that. They'll want to know why you're exceeding it, how long you're going to be exceeding it. It turns out that the Earth is not thoroughly uniform. It has mass concentrations. So that depending on where you are in your one-dimensional real estate, where you've only got a longitude, I might have said latitude, but I'm saying longitude. I mean, a satellite that's as close to Texas as you can get would probably be at a longitude of 100 degrees east of Greenwich. And you've got to stay there. And because there are mass concentrations in the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, the satellite wants to slowly drift downhill, so to speak, to the east or the west, where there's a greater mass concentration below the surface of the Earth. Let me drop this. So that you have to use your positioning gas to periodically do some thrusting in order to stay on station. When your fuel in your satellite starts running low, you have to keep track of that. And as it gets down to the bottom of the tank, you must blast yourself into a higher orbit. The graveyard for geosynchronous orbit satellites is at a higher orbit than 22,300 miles. Let me call it 24,000 miles. Anything at a higher orbit than geosynchronous orbit very slowly spirals outward away from the Earth. Anything closer to the Earth than geosynchronous orbit slowly spirals inward. That's just the dynamics of what happens between a satellite and the Earth. And that's created partially by the tides, among other functions. So as you start running low on fuel, and there's no way to go out there and refuel the thing, you have to blast yourself into the graveyard to get out of the way of the next guy coming up and to make sure you're not going to be a hazard to everybody else. So that major organization is Intelsat. Let me drop. In the case of the United States and Europe and North Korea wanting to launch a satellite simultaneously, I don't know if there is an agency that covers that situation. There might be. On top of that, the chances of them going to the exact same point in the sky at the exact same period of time is essentially zero. I wouldn't worry about that one. And the amount of area you've got out there is so vast that the chances of two guys hitting each other intentionally is a hell of a lot more difficult than you think. So the chances of them hitting, two guys doing a launch and hitting each other unintentionally, very unlikely. A much more likely situation is because you've got, I'm going to pick a number, 10,000 pieces of stuff that's in orbit around the Earth. Some of it north-south orbit, and some of it east, most of it is east-west orbit, but a little bit of it is a polar orbit. The chances of you running into one of those is still very, very low. After all of these years of all of that spacecraft flight, to my knowledge, there has been only one collision that occurred in space. Let's see if Paul confirms all this. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I know Intelsat is very happy about a satellite being built. I think it's called Restore L. Check the name. And it's a satellite that's going to test refueling and possibly eventually repairs. They plan on sending that to an existing satellite to actually do that, you know, as a test. Because if they can do that, they won't have to worry as much with the coordination. They can start refueling these things in space. You know, that's some many years down the road before they can really get that done, but that would help. Another thing that is helping the geosynchronous crowd that's up there is there's so many of them, but they're very long duration satellites. They last for 15, 20 years. Some of them operating that long. So what's happened is a company called SSL makes a lot of these satellites. They pay to put them up there. And I think they're operating at least 50 satellites right now. But they're cutting back. They have workers in San Paulo, I think it is, California. Is the name of the town, I think that's it, in California, that make these things, and now they're starting to lay those people off. We drop it. Because the demand is not there right now. Some of the other companies that are involved with satellite construction, they say they were in the same ballpark. They're starting to slow down. And then, you know, you get companies like SpaceX, they claim they're going to put 4,000 satellites up, but they want to build them themselves. They want to create their own factory. So, who knows? But the market is slowing down a little bit, so that helps back here.
A good buddy of mine, Alan Katz, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel, was working part-time for a company called Lockheed Martin, which has a factory in southwestern New Jersey, or Pennsylvania, I'm not quite sure which. At one time, Lockheed Martin was designing and producing quite a number of those satellites, but maybe those were only the military satellites. So we don't hear much about Lockheed Martin these days compared to these new guys. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Lockheed Martin as partners with Boeing. Now they have a separate group, you know, it's both companies, but you know, it's a separate organization that was created a little over 10 years ago, called ULA, United Launch Alliance, and they're the ones that organize and launch these vehicles. And build these mostly American military launches. You know, they've done a couple of private ones now, and they've before SpaceX, they launched all of NASA's stuff. So ULA, they launch the Atlas V rocket. They launch the Delta II rocket, the Delta IV rocket, the Delta IV Heavy, which launched the Orion spacecraft on a test launch in 2014. So, and they still build satellites and build plenty of things for the military. And, but mainly Boeing is really involved. They're really big at that. But Lockheed Martin is involved quite a bit too.
OK, you might have some more questions on all of the above. AC2LR, Mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is AC2LR. Thank you very much for your answers and your information. I'm good. I'm going to continue to listen. Back to you, Nick.
I just did a quick calculation. Put a satellite in geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles away. 6 times Earth radius. No, wait a minute now. Earth radius is 3956. 3,000, yes. 6 times Earth radius. So the circumference around the Earth is, instead of 24,000 miles, it's more like 150,000 miles. That gives you a little bit of an idea of why trying to hit something in space is so difficult. We're talking about a huge volume out there where these things are located. 6 times more circumference is the orbit of a geosynchronous satellite compared to being something on the surface of the Earth right at the equator. And a good fraction of the distance toward the moon. In fact, the moon is one of the disturbing forces. The Earth concentrations of mass, your satellite wants to slowly slide toward the center of the Atlantic Ocean or the center of the Pacific Ocean. It's being disturbed by solar wind, the moon, all kinds of things. So I am guessing, let me drop. That in order for you to stay on station, you have to use your thruster rockets probably every couple of weeks. You've got to use your thruster rocket to stay on station to not incur that fine from Intelsat. What's your guesses on my part? But I know there's a fine. I know there's a finite volume of space that you're supposed to occupy and nothing else. And you've got a lot of motivation to stay in that spot because your ground station, you don't want to keep moving the pointing of the antenna on the ground that's talking to your satellite. All of the antennas on the ground that are talking to your satellite, you don't want to keep moving them. That's a pain in the neck. Because any error in that orbit means that your ground station antenna has to change its pointing every couple of hours during each 24-hour day. You make any error in the positioning of your satellite, you are going to be drawing a figure eight in space as opposed to sitting at one point. That's just a part of the complication of what happens with orbits. You start drawing a figure eight in space, and you walk around that figure eight once every 24 hours, and all of your ground stations have to follow your position along that figure eight. You can see how undesirable that is. Can we drop? Now, the original guy who asked this question about the efficiency of the ionic engine, let's make sure that that John got his answer on all of that. N2, November, Bravo, Radio. K2RIW for any further questions, John. And speak a little bit softly to be sure.
Comment about the geosynchronous orbit.
You've got a call.
I have a globe in my room, and it's always fun to look at. I've done that many times. It's probably about a foot in diameter. So if you sit 3 feet away from it, you know, three diameters away from it, and then you'll stare at that globe, it gives you an idea of what it would be like sitting out at a geosynchronous orbit. So that's always pretty cool to do. Naturally, you can do that with any ball. There you go. Ion engine you were talking about, he's gone, but they brought up a test solar array that was in the trunk of SpaceX when it went up. This 22 days ago, about 23 days ago. And now that SpaceX cargo vehicle scheduled to come back on July, and it was right before 4th of July, probably July 2nd, and that's going to land in the Pacific Ocean. So that's coming back with science and things on board, science experiments. But on board it had something called a ROSA, Rollout Solar Array. And this thing is, I think they said, about 25% lighter than a regular solar array. And in space, everything is weight. But it also is compact. I think it's like 6 times more dense, rolls up than a normal solar array that they extend out. And this thing opens up, it's got like these two tubes that are rolled up, and the solar rays in between it are, and it just rolls out. They say like a party favor, you know, if you were to blow into a party favor, and this flat thing on, would become a tube like a long piece of pipe. By the time it stretches out, you have two of them, one on the left and one on the right, and in between, this roll-out solar array. They pulled it out of the trunk of Dragon using the robotic arm on the International Space Station. And they put it into action. I saw it on the NASA website. They had a little quick video of the thing actually in space opening up. And now they're going to run some tests. They want to see, if it's mechanically sound in orbit. And then the final test, after it stays open for about a week or two, they're going to actually roll it back up again. So I don't know. I'm not sure of the mechanism. I saw the motors on the end of this thing. But I don't know how it's going to roll it up. How this pipe is going to compress itself back and keep everything square. I'm interested to see how mechanically they do that. But it would be good. One of the reasons they need this is because of the ion engines. They want to drop it. Eventually have very large solar arrays for all this ion engine stuff. So naturally you could have a bigger rocket, you could have a bigger payload, more science equipment, if you could have lighter solar arrays. So that's one of the goals. And this thing was the ROSA, rollout solar array system, tested on Earth. Back chambers, cold. They put it into cold areas. They run the whole test. Now they put it into space just to see how it goes. So they're calling it an experiment and not a demonstration. They just want to test it and then see how it works. Back to you, Dick, WS2M.
BR is... I heard nothing but BR. So I think that is John, and your signal is jumping out of the repeater because you're over-modulating it, John. Speak more softly and try again. Into November Bravo Radio, ? K2RIW in the check net.
How is it?
Okay, you said that was it. I'm not quite sure what that means, John. Go ahead.
Bye.
Okay, a big dropout because you modulated too much, and I heard you say, is that what you're saying? Back to you, John. Speak softly. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, I was just
Trying
to get I was just wondering about the power to weight ratio that ions have over other forms.
I think he's asking for the power-to-weight ratio of ion engines versus chemical engines. And I guess that's really quantified by something called specific impulse. The efficiency of your space propulsion system is called specific impulse. And I think the units are really crazy. It comes out seconds squared or seconds cubed, something like that. So an ionic engine is, about 10 times more efficient in the amount of thrust you get versus the fuel you're using. Is it a 10-to-1 ratio, Paul? Maybe even bigger than that. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it's a couple hundred, 200, 300. I've heard numbers like that. The fuel that they put on Dawn or any, it's only, maybe 800 pounds of neon gas, compressed, to do what Dawn has done, you probably need the space launch system. You probably need a 500,000 gallon tank. It's just incredible. So, you know, the speeds of the protons coming out of there were, I think it's 40 to 80,000 miles per hour. Theoretically, you know, over time, if you kept the thing going, you could get up to that kind of speed. You could never do that with, go into orbit around a planet and deorbit. You would need a gigantic gas tank. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was 500 to 1 to probably more.
Yeah, the efficiency of a rocket engine is a function of what is your exhaust velocity. You have to give up a certain amount of mass. I mean, a simple example I give is that if Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle while he's in orbit, he's in what he calls microgravity. Assume he weighs 200 pounds, and he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand. He pushes the barbell to the north 1 meter per second by Newton's third law, action and reaction. He will start moving 1 meter per second to the south. That's because his exhaust velocity in that case is 1 meter per second. He could, instead of moving a 200-pound barbell, he could move a 1 ounce ping-pong ball, so to speak, but throw it very fast. And as long as he throws it fast enough, it would again move him 1 meter per second. So the exhaust velocity is what really creates efficiency of a rocket engine. A chemical rocket engine, I don't think the exhaust velocity is much different than the speed of sound, or a couple of times the speed of sound. Whereas an ionic engine, in theory, you could exhaust those particles at a fraction of the speed of light if you got a big enough accelerator section. That's the good news. The bad news is an ionic engine only gives you a couple of ounces of thrust, or maybe even less than that. Very little thrust, but for a very long time at very high efficiency. You'll never use an ionic engine to blast off from the Earth. Let me drop it.
Dick, by the way, it's the equivalent of one piece of paper in your hand. That's the power you got.
That's the force that you get, a piece of paper in your hand. With the sizes of ionic engines that have been used to date, you're saying it's got the same?
Repeater, time out.
So I think you're saying, Paul, it's got the same amount of force as a piece of paper in your hand. Wow. What's that approximate number? Are we talking about a milligram? Go ahead.
I've read these numbers before, but I think it's 1 millinewton. I really don't know. But I think 1 newton of force, you probably know, Dick, I think that's 1 gram spread over 1 meter. So it's probably a touch more than that for your ion engine. But the thing is, like a chemical engine will go up, you know, blast you for 8 minutes, and then you start to slow down. I mean, even if you're going to the moon, you're slowing down. You're starting off at 25,000 miles an hour. By the time you're halfway there, over halfway there, you're down to 4,000 miles an hour. With the ion engines, you know, you don't shut them off for years on end, you know. So as long as you've got enough power to overcome the gravity well on Earth, you're going to keep accelerating. Back to you.
I think a newton of force is in the vicinity of a quarter of a pound, a newton of force. A newton, I think, is defined as 1 kilogram of mass accelerated at 1 meter per second squared. So you move it 1 meter per second faster during each second, a kilogram of mass, and that's 1 newton. So a millinewton is a quarter of a gram, I think, of force. It's rather small. And as such, but you can do it 24/7. So you wait long enough, you build up some very nice velocity with an ionic engine at very high efficiency. But you got to live with small force. In the case of a chemical engine, you can get a million pounds of force out of it, but you're carrying a couple of million pounds of fuel with you during the 8 minutes to do it. and the majority of the mass that you're accelerating is the fuel that you're bringing with you. The early science fiction movies like Destination Moon, a movie that was popular around 1951 or so. Let me drop it. It was a great big rocket that blasted off from the Earth. It turned around tail first and slowly lowered itself down to the moon. And then it blasted off the moon and came back to Earth. That looked like the right way to do it in 1951. And during the Apollo early days, somebody did a couple of back of the envelope calculations and realized that the Saturn V, with something like 6 million pounds of thrust, or whatever, 7 million pounds of thrust, it would have been about 4 to 1 too small to be able to go directly to the moon. And already that was a big undertaking. That thing is 350 feet tall. Takeoff weight is something close to 7 million pounds. And it was way too small. It was until some engineer, some mathematician, invented lunar orbit rendezvous, that only a tiny little portion of the original spacecraft goes down into that gravity well on the moon and comes back, rejoins the object that's in orbit and comes back home. That saves you a tremendous amount of thrusting capability, fuel, dollars, everything else. We would have never gone to the moon had somebody not invented lunar orbit rendezvous. But it was an idea so radical at the time, he had to go through all kinds of backdoor techniques to get the engineers at NASA to even look at his paper to realize that that's the only way we're going to get to the moon. The other way we would have never have gotten there. We dropped. So we've used up our time for tonight. I was going to ask you a question about CubeSat. I'm going to sign off officially. This was TechNet number 1656. That was Space Report number 256. Bye-bye, you all be kind to each other. But I was asked at one of the field day operations, what's the easiest place I can go to read about CubeSats? How many have been built, who built them, and what they're doing with them? I told him there's a bunch of YouTube videos, that if you go to YouTube video and search on the word CubeSat, I think you'll get a lot of information. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
Group called Rock On. They build these CubeSats. In fact, Mike, you got a mental blank, I forget his call letter. Mike number two, you know, takes care of the Limar TechNet website. He personally was involved doing that, involved with CubeSats, got involved with the launch down on Wallace Island in Virginia and all. So it's a group called, and the one he was involved with is called Rock On. So if you put on Rock On Rockets, or, you know, something of that nature into Google, you'll be able to probably get some information about that. There's dozens and dozens that fly every year. NanoRack is another group. NanoRack gets these CubeSats up to the International Space Station for you. Back to you.
2NBR.
Yeah, Mike number two is K1MJM, K1 Mike, Juliet Mike. I went to his QRZ.com website hoping that he's got an email address. I don't see a website address there. Okay, I think I heard N2, November, Bravo, Ram, Romeo. Speak softly and go right ahead, John. Okay. So we're going to be discussing that later, is what John was saying. And you were dropping out 30% of the time on that transmission. So in the coming week, anything you can do to give us a little bit more RF energy toward this repeater would be very helpful, John. And know that if you're using a handy-talkie, for instance, if you position it around the room where you get the strongest signal when you're listening to the repeater, That is not necessarily the strongest signal when you transmit to the repeater.